Hello, I'm Harry Glorikian, and this is The Harry Glorikian Show, where we explore how technology is changing everything we know about healthcare. Most of the new medicines and treatments that are beating back disease, from antibody therapies to vaccines, were invented and tested in wet labs that look the same and work the same pretty much everywhere. These labs are full of incubators and refrigerators and centrifuges and liquid handlers and gene sequencers and DNA and RNA synthesizers and all sorts of other complex equipment. And a lot of this equipment is automated, but the larger workflow in a life sciences R&D lab is very much not automated. For the most part, it's individual researchers who decide how and when to use each piece of equipment, and individuals who move samples and materials back and forth between the machines. An investor friend of mine named Kuki Harasaki at Microsoft's M12 Venture Fund commented that even inside the pharma giants, labs are more like test kitchens than factories. And why is that a problem? Well, because sometimes, if you're trying to collect evidence for a scientific paper or a regulatory filing, or trying to manufacture a product that's verifiably safe, you need to make sure that the same procedure gets carried out exactly the same way every time. This week on the show, I have a guest who believes that life sciences labs will always revolve around manual labor, but thinks there's a way to orchestrate the process more precisely. His name is David Fuller, and he's the CEO of a company called Artificial. Artificial makes software that allows lab managers to create what he calls a digital twin of their entire laboratory. Inside this digital twin, data structures track what's happening with each piece of lab equipment and keep them in sync, even if they're from different manufacturers. The software provides what Fuller calls a single pane of glass that makes it easier to see the state of the equipment and the science as it's running in your lab, meaning what's happening, why it's happening, and what errors may be cropping up. Humans will always stay in the loop, but Fuller says the benefit for companies who orchestrate their labs in this way is that the data and the products coming out of the lab will be more consistent. Research programs can move to completion faster, more affordably, and more repeatably. And that will be even more important as laboratories start to act more like factories, where a lot of the actual production of biologic drugs or other materials happens. I had a wide-ranging and mind-expanding conversation with David about the role of automation and AI in the modern life sciences lab, and I want to play it for you now. David, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks, Harry. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So, you know, I was so pleased, like, you know, learning about the company, seeing what you guys are doing, digging into it. But before we get into the company, I'd love to talk to you about your background. You know, I do this with a lot of my guests because it's like, how did you get here? but, you know, because you don't come out of the life sciences industry. Your experience has been in sort of advanced robotics, industrial robotics to be specific. I think it was a name, a company called KUKA, which was a Chinese-owned, Germany-based robotic maker for supplying car companies with assembly line robots. So just to put it into perspective for everybody that's listening, like, how did you go from an industrial robot to biopharma? And then how did you end up founding Artificial? What made you think of sort of software and life sciences?
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate that. Yeah, it's an origin story that is fairly indirectly arriving in the life sciences space. So maybe a little bit on my background, and I'll try to do a thumbnail and not belabor the points. But, you know, I've been in love with programming computers since I was a kid. Got a degree here in Texas from Texas A&M in computer engineering. And then immediately started at like age 18 for an Austin-based company called National Instruments, rebranded as NI, where I worked from age 18 to 43. So I wasn't exactly, you know, startup entrepreneur oriented. I wasn't exactly life sciences focused. And that was a great place to learn how to be a solid engineer. They make tools for scientists and engineers to solve super complex problems that are a combination of software and hardware. I mean, I focused on the software side. So those were my sort of days of an engineer programming, making tools for scientists. One sort of claim to fame for National Instruments from a commercial point of view that's more broadly known, because they're fairly niche in the test and measurement space. They're still about a $1 billion company, but it's still somewhat esoteric. They partnered with Lego Mindstorms to build the robotic software for the Lego robots. To me, this was an amazing sort of realization that here we are working on this fairly complex, fairly market independent technology that can be applied to things like the CERN Hadron Collider. So they control the beams that shoot back and forth to make sure it doesn't run into the wall. It's the foundation of SpaceX ground control. But at the same time, you know, learning from Lego, we were able to say, okay, can we take this really complex concept, narrow it down and apply it in a domain where lots of people can use it, including children? So this was for me sort of an epiphany of, it's not that there isn't amazing technology that solves a lot of problems. It's that a technology is not accessible, usable, or understandable by the people that really need it as a tool. Mm-hmm. So this is one key pillar and learning that fed into, you know, how I ended up at Artificial working on tools for scientists in the lab automation space. So around 9 years ago now, I met the then CEO of the KUKA Group. And so at the time, KUKA was a fully German-owned industrial robotic company. If you see the car commercials showing Detroit or all of these other things, it's the big giant orange robots throwing around hunks of steel. So I went to work on that for them, really focused on how to apply modern internet-based technology, the best that it has to offer, plus things emerging in the AI space, and could we take that and shake it up and apply it to disrupt industrial robots? So I moved to Germany, became their CTO of their group, looked at logistics and super high throughput automation. But I kept coming into this duality of two key sets of problems that again feed into Artificial. And so one is what I'll just call digitization. I hate to use the term, but you know, it broadly means everything to anybody that's using a computer. But for me, modern digitization is basically, have you taken the fundamental infrastructure and front-end technology of the internet, which is the most amazing at-scale, fully integrated cyber-physical system on the planet, and have you applied it to your problem domain? And if you haven't, you haven't digitized. I mean, that's basic. You can have old school desktop stuff and you can have 90s era tech, but if you haven't done that, you haven't digitized. So digitization, even though it's a hyped buzzword, is real, which is, have you modernized on digital infrastructure? The other one is just automation. And automation is a more niche, less scaled, complex domain. It deals with the boundary of the real world and the digital world, and it's messy. And so you end up with, in robotics, in the industry, in automotive, in electronics, and warehouse logistics, digital interfacing with physical, complex. So I did that for a bunch of years, trying to hyper-optimize, you know, how fast you can make a car body come off a production line. So I did a lot of screening of AI companies, and this ultimately gets to how we ended up at starting a company and focusing on life sciences, was I love the pillars of digitization and automation. I love the ease of use and democratization of complex capabilities for people. In this case, I was really looking for a market that was both well capitalized, so I need to have something of substantial size, but one that I actually could get behind and believe in and motivated me on some fundamental level. I'm getting older. I want to work on things that motivate me. And so for me, there is no better purpose than what I see in the life sciences space. This was pre-COVID, and it's never been, you know, even more amplified as to the noble mission of the entire market. So it's profitable, it's well capitalized, it has an amazing purpose. So that mix said, okay, how can I take a lifetime of interests in digitization and automation and enter a market that motivated me? And so that was sort of, I had the luck of running into a venture capital firm that I would say had the same appetite for the same kind of AI companies as me. Mm-hmm. And I got to know one of the partners. And we thought, you know, post KUKA, we should do something together. And so I had the fortune and opportunity and responsibility of stepping out of what had basically been climbing the ladder in well-established mid-sized multinationals, and wake up one day in my office going, so it's just me and a few other people, and what the hell are we doing? And that's been fantastic, a fantastic journey. So that mix of life sciences market, trying to unlock the automation domain for scientists, combined with expertise in digitization and automation, is the mix that defines the purpose of artificial.
Yeah, no, I mean, and it's funny because the way you described what's so fascinating about this market is why I've never left since I started in this market, right? It's like, why would anybody want to work in another market? This is awesome. but I'm biased. So, now artificial is sort of helping biopharma companies and maybe more, right? Because I don't know all the clients, right? Basically automate their lab automation. But, you know, before we talk about the technology you're building, right? Can you give us a picture of the existing state of automation in the life sciences industry? And you know, at some point I'd like to get into your explanation of automation, because I usually think of, you know, a lot of people may think of automation as like just moving one thing from one place to another. This is way more intense and complex in the number of operations that are happening and what's happening.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's, you know, words super matter. And so it's interesting that we started off on this journey presupposing that the problem we wanted to go straight at was what I'll just call hardcore automation. And given my background and the background of a lot of the folks, that's basically where we started. I think we deserve kudos, not necessarily me, but my other co-founder, who's great, Nikita Singh. You know, she's one of the best product management people I've ever worked with. We did exactly an exhaustive tour of labs to answer the question you just asked her, which was like, hey, what's up with the current state of automation in the lab? Let's find out where some of the problems are. And what we found is, you know, there's a massively important separation that bifurcates labs and labs broadly in the loosest term. You know, are you production oriented? That is, you are trying to produce either a diagnostic or good as an output. You bias towards looking like a classic factory, right? What's your widget rate? And you like low mix and high volume, and it's all of the automation stuff that you can pretty much formulaically describe. And then you enter into the chaotic, crazy area of research where it's less structured if you move onto the other side of the wall, where you're looking at drug discovery and emerging, you know, new diagnostics. You're perhaps looking at new forms of modalities and methodologies related to things like synthetic biology. So from my view, it's super important to separate production from R&D, which is already, you know, obviously separated in most minds of people that know the life sciences market, but they also have very different needs from an automation point of view. So we'll put a pin in that we're focused on the R&D space, which can broadly be described as a roboticist as moderately unstructured. So that's sort of where we've been focused. Now, along the way to the forum of looking at like, okay, let's do automation for R&D. We really uncovered a current important, what is the state of the current lab problem, that moved us a little bit away from what I'll call the word automation to a couple of other words, which I can talk about, one being orchestration and the other one being operations. So when we look at the state of play in the current R&D lab, you know, it is naive to think that it can be fully automated. So let's have a hands-free, all robots moving all materials, you know, liquid handler classes abstracted. I say some magic words and I get a magic result, right? I mean, and this is sort of the ideal storytelling phase, is like, you know, the scientist just does ask what they want and out pops the thing. That's just not the case. So what we're seeing is there's a huge amount of manual labor still involved. There's a human in the loop from a central decision-making point of view, which we do not think is going away. Right. That's just, that this is not going away. There are aspects of the operations of a lab that can be automated, but the central decision maker being the human will remain. So what we end up with is a hybrid automation use case where a large percentage of the lab processes will remain manual, but formulaic, embodied in standard operating procedures. So this all mixed together led us to some following conclusions. We have to integrate automated SOPs, assays, et cetera, that mix a lot of human interaction with islands of automation that do very bespoke, powerful, amazing things, but they're still just one little box doing a magic thing as part of the process. It's a liquid handler, it's a centrifuge, it's whatever it is. So that led us to move away from pure automation because, you know, you're not really automating humans. You're helping them with digital instructions to capture repeatable workflows that seamlessly flow data back and forth between automation and the scientist or the automation engineer. So it's under digitized, lots of paper SOPs, lots of random human interactions because humans are random, with limited data movement in an automated fashion. And so it's pretty undigitized and unautomated from our point of view. So our goal is to wrap the human in a digital cocoon of really good instructions for what needs to get done with the automation so it's approachable, connect data of the human actions with the robotic actions, capture all of that in a digital record, and put it in a place in the cloud that's ready for AI or analytics or compliance analysis. So that's sort of the state of the play and what we found. And the gaps were in human interactions and data collection and normalization.
Yeah, I keep hoping or I keep wishing for, you know, the Harry Potter magic wand where everything sort of does what you want it to do, which would be sort of awesome. Actually, my son was saying, God, Dad, wouldn't it be awesome if we had one of those to clean the house? But I think, you know, one of your board members, Kuki, who I also know from M12, right, said, you know, most labs operate more like test kitchens than factories, right? So if you're doing a test kitchen, you're constantly picking up a different spice. You're working on a different aspect. You're trying to make something happen, you know, to see what happens at the end. You're testing multiple variables. So you got to have enough flexibility built in there to allow them to be able to do that.
That's right. I think that dovetails into, and cooking is a great metaphor of like artistry versus industrial kitchen and the flexibility in, say, a test kitchen. What's interesting for me is like, one, if you are in the analogy of I'm experimenting in a fluid sort of way, whether it's cooking or it's drug discovery or whatever, wouldn't it be nice if, as you were taking actions, all of what you were doing was being observed so that if you actually liked the outcome, you had a mechanism to remember the exact steps, variables, methodologies, and things that were done to produce the result in an efficient and easy way without having to go and take your own notes in a constant manner or have it unstructured in paper and things like that. So that process of flexibly doing sets of known lab operations, tracking sample origin history, what happened to it, who did it and when, how long was it where, you know, all of the things that go into the art of the initial discovery, you know, we help track that, absolutely.
So why would the average consumer care about like the primitive state of lab automation? Is there a way for you to translate it, you know, if you're explaining it to your, you know, your grandmother, let's say, in the most basic terms, you know, is the lack of lab automation a major obstacle holding back, say, faster drug development, as for example, or something else?
Yeah. So why automate or why do we care, right? So let me back up and I'll steal an analogy that I've always loved for tools that unlock efficiency and productivity. Let's harken back to the 1980s and the early 1980s. And we'll say, okay, what was the state of play of bookkeeping? You know, what did accountants do? So I reconciled receipts for a restaurant in college. And I sat there with my paper tape and I would add things up and I wrote it down in a journal and I, you know, it was great, whiteout and all sorts of stuff. At the same time, we had just bought a PC and had Lotus 1-2-3 in the back office and no one knew how to use it. So if you look at the way that the artist accountant reconciled books and their efficiency on back office and in finance and in banking. And it was all manual in ledgers and on paper. And you look at what happened when ubiquitous computing combined with a spreadsheet unlocked productivity. It's like, well, what was the value of the productivity to the world going from paper ledgers and unstructured formats to a regularized spreadsheet that we all know how to use and share information in? It was a phenomenal transformation that we just sort of take for granted as like, well, yeah, everybody's more efficient by a massive amount. So I think there's a huge amount of money being spent. I think there's a huge amount of loss and friction in the system from the tools not providing repeatable, reliable results in a generalized way that are globally shareable. And so there's just a massive inefficiency drain on our ability to deliver new drugs, new therapies to the market. And there's another trend that I think is really important as catalyzing what is hap why it is even more important is that the difference for some really amazing new therapies between the R&D lab and the production lab can start to disappear. So if I'm creating a solution that's unique to you, and I'm extracting your blood and growing your cells and modifying your genes and putting them back into your body, that's a lot sized one production methodology. There is no production oriented, pure factory for Harry's genes, right? It's and the tooling and the hardware and software side basically are still primarily R&D oriented. And so you have this convergence of the wall between production and R&D is going away. And it's pretty profound, both profound from a business model point of view about, what happens when there's no repetitive therapy and it's a pure cure that's unrelated to us. More related to us is it's a lot sized one manufacturing using R&D methodologies. So we should care because the most important, newest, amazing therapies that are transforming the world from CAR T to gene editing need automation, but are using R&D oriented solutions that are largely manual.
I'm not sure that everybody understands that shift that's happening or what's happening in that space. But let's shift here now to, what is artificial's approach to solving this problem, right? You're not trying to replace existing equipment with new hardware built by artificial, right? It's your technology is about helping companies build digital twins of their laboratories to bring together software representations of their existing equipment. I'm going to ask you if that's like a correct assessment on my part.
That was a very correct assessment, clinically written. Yes,
Okay.
absolutely.
But a digital twin is a term that comes from, I was explaining it to someone, else in a conversation the other day. I was giving a lecture, but it's from the Industrial Internet of Things, right? People who don't follow that area might not understand the definition of a digital twin. Can you sort of give us an example?
Yeah, absolutely. I find it in a grand fit of cosmic irony. I now use most of the terms that I really despise for most of my career. And digital twin is one of them. And you're right, its origins are in the industrial space. I had the pleasure of working with Dr. Henning Kargemann, who was the founder of Germany's view of Industry 4.0. He was also the CEO and executive vice president of SAP. So a very, very powerful intellect. He wrote a book on Industry 4.0. IIoT in the US is based off of the theories in that book, and he is one of the ones that focused on digital twinning. So as a computer scientist, I think it's a fancy word for a well-defined data structure, which is just like, are you tracking information about the thing in the real world in a reasonable way in the digital world? That's like the most basic view of it. Now, if you have that data structure and it's just sitting there and it's meaningless in a certain way other than being pure data, there's an implied with digital twins connection to a thing in the real world. So I have a thing in the real world, I have its twin in the digital world. There's attributes and fields and metadata and structures that describe the real thing. and then I keep them in sync. So if the real thing moves, the field that says where is it located updates in some reasonable time in the cloud, and then the world can globally understand, you know, the thing moved. So this idea of tracking a real world entity with a digital entity in a centralized view on the internet, you know, for me is sort of the most basic definition of a digital twin. There must be a real thing, there's a corresponding digital thing, they're connected in sync somehow. Sometimes I can change the digital thing and it affects the real world element. Sometimes the real world element moves and the digital element updates. So that is the underpinning concept. It's not exactly complex. It's like, yeah, if I have a real thing, I want to track it in the digital world. Okay, it's a digital twin. So that is the basics. When we look at artificial, we are not creating hardware. We're not trying to go after, you know, the deep, rich, amazing domains of automation and instrumentation that are the domain of the liquid handlers and the sequencers and so on. I think these are not areas that we're interested in going after. What we see is that there is such a breadth of complexity, domain know-how, and never mind the scientific complexity and domain know-how that happens in a lab, that's a really amazingly rich, complex place. So rich that it's a barrier to having a scientist come in who just wants to get something done with their automated lab. And so if I have five vendors with five different kinds of instrumentation, and I have a scientific process that in and of itself is massively complex, and then I have all the software domain of my ELN and my LEMS and my automation software, it's like, which one human being on the planet can understand what needs to happen there? And the answer is really no one. Okay, maybe if you have that person, great, they have their own unicorn billion-dollar company, but there's not a lot of them. And so our mission is to provide what we call a single pane of glass that makes it easier and more understandable to see the state of the equipment and the science as it's running in your lab. And to do that, the normalizing factor, like what makes it homogeneous and approachable, are digital twins. So the digital twin representation of a liquid handler from TCAN, a thermo robot, a precise robot, they all end up in one canvas, and it's like, oh, I can look at my lab, and no matter the complexity of the equipment or who it came from, I can understand what's happening, why it's happening, what errors are there, you know, how long have my plate of cells been sitting there, you know, what's the reading on the cell count, et cetera. So this is, for us, how we start with approachability for scientists to work with their automation teams to understand and use their lab effectively.
So essentially, it's making it much easier to move the process forward and also, like, reconfigure the whole process.
Yeah, so this is the reconfiguration part is critical. And I'll use it just a very practical basic example of approachability and the interplay between the scientist and, say, an automation team. Typically, sometimes it converges into one person for sure, but often at scale it doesn't. I have a liquid handler. It's a great thing. It's from TCAN or Hamilton or whomever. I need to run, you know, some sort of assay. To do that, I have to configure the deck with the proper layout. With, you know, these are very practical things like, how many test tubes do I need to have in the tube rack? What kind of plates need to be on these plate nests? You know, this is configuring the physical things that are going to move elements of your samples and the reagents in a process. Knowing how to do that when you have a bunch of things going on is not easy to keep track of. We have a digital twin that represents the desired state of physical reality. And then we have a set of instructions, tools to create instructions so that I, as a scientist, could walk up and go, oh, I need to do NGS sample prep. Here's the deck layout. Let me go and configure it. And we'll guide them through that and check that it's done correctly. Very basic, but if you are slightly intimidated about using that equipment because you don't use it all the time, or you don't know how to reconfigure certain elements of it, or what you need to use from a quantity point of view is related to the amount of samples and the complexity of the experiment, complexity keeps growing. We can abstract away all of that with the intent that scientists use more equipment more efficiently and work better with their automation teams. So this productivity through ease of use is a critical point for us.
Let's pause the conversation for a minute to talk about one small but important thing you can do to help keep the podcast going. And that's leave a rating and review for the show on Apple Podcasts. All you have to do is open Apple Podcast app on your smartphone, search for The Harry Glorikian Show, and scroll down to the ratings and review section. Tap the stars to rate the show, and then tap the link that says write a review to leave your comments. It'll only take 30 seconds, but you'll be doing a lot to help other listeners discover the show. And one more thing. If you like the interviews we do here on the show, I know you'll like my new book, The Future You, How Artificial Intelligence Can Help You Get Healthier, Stress Less, and Live Longer. It's a friendly and accessible tour of all the ways today's information technologies are helping us diagnose disease faster, treat them more precisely, and create personalized diet and exercise programs to prevent them in the first place. The book is now available in print and ebook formats. Just go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble and search for The Future You by Harry Glorikian. And now, back to the show. Can you give us, say, maybe a before and after picture of how life gets easier for an artificial customer when they start using your software to rationalize their laboratory process? I mean, I think there's a good case study on your website about Beam Therapeutics, and I do like watching his videos on LinkedIn every once in a while. but maybe you could use them as an example?
Sure, absolutely. So I think it comes back to the before and after is, before is disconnected, highly paper-oriented, lots of information in different places without a single clear view of what work is there to be done, what work is being done and how is it going, and what work has been done and do I have a clean digital record of the scientific data, the automation data, and what the people did. So before, in the most basic sense, it's less productive, it's less integrated and usable, and it's less observable. So when it's not as observable in a complete way, and it's not as approachable in a complete way, then we view that as a very inefficient lab. And that's not to say that labs aren't, I just want to keep being very careful. Labs have amazing aspects of scientific instrumentation. Absolutely. It's the connection of the flow holistically, so as many people as possible can use it. That is our goal. And so the before is largely disconnected, largely unobservable, and not a complete picture of a data record in a centralized place. You know, there's this, just to, so that's what happened at Beam. If you look at the case study, that's what we're doing with other customers. I look at it from a, you know, I have seen and I've been on both sides of discussions around AI-driven robotics, AI-driven factories, AI-driven warehouses. You know, what's interesting is there's a lot of like lab of the future, AI driven drug discovery. We're just going to close the loop on the lab and, you know, magic will happen and all of these things. And I've been pursuing that goal in one form or another with practical old school techniques and applying the new ones in different domains. This is also related to the Beam before and after. Look, most of the state of the market talks about those things, but if you ask them, do you keep a digital record of what everyone did in an R&D context as they're flexibly working, which you would need to feed to your AI? Do you track the people? No. Are your instruments connected where the process data and the instrument measurement data is correlated in time to what people are doing and what samples are in it? No. You know, okay, so you don't have that. Do you normalize across instrument categories so that you have a digestible digital twin with a standard view of the same physical concept so that you can learn on a common piece of data describing a common thing? No. Okay, so all of the preconditions that define where we, and these are not the wrong places to go. We definitely want to go where we've solved these problems. All of those preconditions add value in the immediate case to make the lab more usable, more trackable, more reproducible, and move towards this dream. I don't like talking about the dream. I like talking about that let's solve the problems right in front of us to move the state of the lab towards the dream.
Right. So you could sort of open the door to, you know, artificial intelligence and machine learning. Where do those techniques come into the picture? I mean, does an automated lab generate cleaner, more interoperable data that can be used as training sets for AI ML? I mean, what can customers accomplish with AI once they've automated their workflows, right? I'm asking because I, you know, love to get a better picture of the world that you're trying to sort of corral the cats towards and get them to end up in that place. And then I think I've heard this term quite a bit is a closed loop lab, right? And how they're enabled by artificial intelligence. I mean, maybe you can touch on those pieces just to give everybody a flavor of, because this show is about, you know, where data and biology intersect and how we employ all these, tools that are, everybody's bantering around these words in the world.
Right, absolutely. I think everyone is bantering them around. I just want to say, I don't think many are applying them in a productive way. Because let's imagine the perfect outcome, which is I have some centralized trained model that's connected to enough information that it's learned how to efficiently suggest some form of drug discovery. And that would be, first off, that statement would be phenomenal if we're applying it in practical, useful, amazingly targeted, successful ways. So let's imagine that we have that. Then you need to go with it a closed loop, which is I'm looking at what's happening in the lab. I have a lot of data coming in. I have a centralized model I'm training. It's learning and getting better and better at making suggestions as to what to do next. And then it's affecting the real world by suggesting the next automated operation to run in the lab with a different set of inputs to maybe find a more efficacious drug. Right. So the closed loop is basically it's the loop as old as the scientific process. Run an experiment, record the results, infer something about what to do next, run another one. And so that's the loop. And the difference here is rather than a human in the loop and moving at the pace of human experimentation and human thought, we're trying to close that loop more efficiently with automated systems. So do automated systems produce better repeatable results compared to humans? Yes. Do they produce data that is more normalized and structured than an unautomated system? Almost assuredly. So your chances of success of closing the loop go way up if you're automating it as much as possible. Now, I want to back up a little bit to some very specific, tangible example of applied AI. But it also relates to me about, you know, when is the human going to be the one in the loop versus when is the machine going to be the one in the loop? And so, you know, we're working with companies that are doing a lot of cell culturing, like I was alluding to. It's basically, hey, I need to look at a plate of cells and figure out what to do. Do I need to grow them some more? Can I move them on to the next step? And you're using analytical instruments to take measurements to check out how the cells are doing. That's fine. And then the question is, who makes the decision to move it on? And is that decision a model in the loop or is it a human in the loop? And then you run into some very fascinating things. We have the technology to train models to look at image results on a plate and decide what should happen next. But in a lot of the cases we're seeing, it's not trusted by the scientists who are the artful ones who need to make the decision and have made the decision for years. And so there is a human element to this related to adoption of the technology by the people that are really controlling what's happening in these labs, which are the scientists. So I believe cell culturing is a fundamental, perfect example of I want to automate more. I want to normalize the data more. I want to feed it to models. I want the models to be expert decision makers. But I want to keep the human in the loop so that together we can grow confidence that the suggestions of the model are correct. And so the envisioned future is, yeah, I can efficiently and with as little human interaction as possible, reliably grow whatever kind of cells I need to grow for these new therapies or these new diagnostics. And AI and automation can be a huge part of it, but I don't think we're going to flip the market if we don't bring the humans along. And so I think tactical applications where there's a very clear human decision should be evaluated on a case-by-case basis to replace with AI. But I think it's going to take years and years to get there. I mean, just as some statistics that I find useful. So in my role as the CTO of the KUKA group, there was a constant analysis of white space on processes. So if you look at car production, you know, which has been a global hobby for very large companies for a very long time, you know, there's like 4% of the known processes required to build cars that are not completely automated. It's like in final assembly of the car itself. So there's not a whole lot of room of growth in car production. You know, electronic batteries, you know, threw them a little curveball. So they had to, oh, we have to have a new battery production process. You know, so that's flowed through the system already. So that's gone. And so you're basically left with not a whole lot left to automate. I was talking to big pharma folks and a few in a bunch of other labs in the space. In the context we're talking about, you know, we've got 10% reliably automated. So and it's always changing at a much more rapid pace, you know, than what you see in, say, production of cars, because the technology really hasn't shifted much. So I love the lab domain. It's rich with complexity. It's a mix of people and machines. The science is always advancing at a rapid pace. I think it's an amazing dynamic environment, and you need tools designed to deal with that evolution and dynamism, and tools that deal with the people and the machines.
Yeah, I remember we used to like, I knew people. I was like, that's the person you want because they will get it to work. Like all these other people, that's not going to, I mean, it was almost like that artist that you had to pick because you knew that they had it, you know, the imagination and the way they could sort of manipulate something. There's not that many people that are like that. You actually need automation to get this thing to move faster. But, you know, this is the question that really comes up, like for every area when we're talking about automation and artificial intelligence, right? In a lab equipped with artificial, right? Are there fewer scientists? Do companies employ the same number of scientists, but just put them to work doing higher value things and less manual work? I mean, what's the dynamic and where is it headed?
I don't think that specifically with artificial, this was a much more complicated question when I was building huge amounts of industrial robots. but for artificial in the context of the lab, we do not foresee it as sort of labor replacement. Only in the extent that the labor you have is more efficient in what they're doing. So, you know, it's a tool if it makes you more efficient and you only need to get one thing done. And with that tool now, you know, one person can do it instead of two. It's like, okay, yes, that's the case. You had some sort of efficiency gain. There's a lot of analogies talking about this, but like, I don't think the spreadsheet reduced the number of accountants. as an example, it unlocked the potential to go further, faster as a business and share more information in a normalized way. With artificial, we believe you can capture repeatable digital SOPs so that more people can do more science. We think that you can have protocols and assays that can run against different kinds of equipment so that you have a repeatable process across labs. You know, these are forms of, hey, shouldn't the digital tools address these common pain points in running a lab and create it so that you can be more efficient in doing it? And more importantly to me, like really fundamentally important, I can share it with other people with a better chance of repeating it. And so those things don't replace work. They make companies more efficient in doing work and doing new work and doing more work. And from my view, you know, the appetite of the consumer and of people for, can I live better, longer, in a more enjoyable way, is not going away. So if you solve one problem, it's not like there's another problem that humans don't want you to solve in the domain you're in. So I just don't see it as a, it's the, for me, it's a common question, But I've never viewed productivity enhancing tools as bad for society. And in the case of the lab specifically, I think it's just more and better of what we need.
Oh, no. In healthcare and life sciences, I mean, we're way behind almost every other, you know, industrial sector. So we've got a lot to do to catch up. And it's exciting. I mean, I love being on this part of the curve because it's a very interesting place to be. So
yeah, I just the one comment on that, because it really touched on one of the things that I think is super important. Like when I dig into the lab, and like you said, I do think in the absolute scorecard, you know, relative to other markets, like I was just describing, the penetration of automation to replace processes is as a percentage really low.
Right.
Now, it's not because brilliant people from the dawn of society on haven't been looking at these problems. You know, I really, my favorite punchline internally is life is more complicated than a car. And so it's like, there's justifiable reason for the pace of automation adoption. On the other hand, there is no justifiable reason for the pace of digitization adoption.
Correct.
And so I think there is a laggard mentality in this market, both in tool adoption and software adoption, that is really hurting the global efficiency of the life sciences space. One is excusable by the complexity of the domain. You know, automation lagging is, I think, inherent to the complexity. The digitization thing, I think, says a lot about the existing market and things that are opportunities and really should change quickly.
Yeah. And I believe that in the last 10 years, we have seen a significant shift for many reasons. I mean, if you're specifically talking about healthcare, right, it's everything was on paper, right? And then they got forced to move to EMRs, which, you know, frankly, I'm not sure I would have pushed everybody to go on to a glorified accounting system and called it a patient management system. But that's a different show. But what does success look like for artificial? What, I mean, you know, would it be possible in a world where every biolab was managing its workflow using artificial? Or, you know, do you think the company can become the behemoth on its own? Or do you see a future where you have to pair with an existing, you know, behemoth like a Thermo Fisher so that you have access to all these different pieces of equipment? What does it look like for you?
Right. It's a fine question. I think I think about that one every morning when I wake up. I was like, what is it that is the end goal? Now, I think we have a pretty consistent vision technologically and product-wise of like the problems we think are the North Star of what we're going after. And so I'll take your question in two parts. It's essentially, what does the fruition of the application of the product look like as it matures and grows in our vision? And then business-wise, what are the ingredients necessary for that vision to be globally adopted in a really broad way, right? I think these are two important questions for us. So like, what is our end goal technologically and business-wise? And I haven't touched on it as much, but there's a really important catalyst for why we started focusing on digital SOPs for people, as well as workflows for mixing human and automated operation. So why that? So right when I was first looking at how to apply the seed funding that we got as a startup, and we did a lot of this analysis of the current state of the lab, COVID hit. And so I'm not a lab scientist, full stop. But I did go to the World Health Organization shortly after, you know, some of the national agencies around the world had started looking at how can I test for this thing. And I downloaded 17 white papers from the World Health Organization that came from Germany, from the US, from the early people that were publishing their COVID tests. Those papers were incredibly varied, massively heterogeneous. Different forms of legalese, different forms of quality of English. No offense to my German brethren who I've lived with and, you know, love working with. You know, it was their of course, their essay worked. Mm-hmm. The World Health Organization had a great, beautiful, legally perfect 20-page document that did not initially. And so we had this this sort of like, why in the world would we not have a standard way to describe how to do a known set of activities that we could then share? And when I shared it, it could be run. And when it ran, it did the same thing. Now, that's a simple statement. And I know under the covers, there's different kinds of equipment, different reagent mixes, different methodologies. Those should be the things we smooth away with the digital tools over time. I don't think it'll ever be perfect, but you could say, to your point, in partnership with Thermo, here is an assay that reliably, repeatedly does a diagnostic. And in the end, you know, what you had was companies like Thermo who rallied around that quickly to produce a fixed thing that did exactly that.
Right.
But that was in the latter days, post the research and discovery and more of the generalization. So in answer to your question, I believe the world needs a standard way to describe scientific processes using standard lab equipment to capture what the people need to do and what the machines need to do and be able to run it portably as possible across equipment. And in that sense, we would have a standard language for executing scientific experiments, drug discovery, et cetera, in a lab. That is our mission.
I mean, you almost want to teach that. You'd want, you know, a class or a subset of a class on that so that anybody graduating would be able to go out and be fully functional.
Yeah. I believe that if you had such a thing and you had digital twins and you could run it in the cloud and you could observe how these processes work and interact with the equipment like you can with our twins and follow along a scientific set of instructions and see it in action, simulated or virtualized, and you had the standard thing, you know, ELISA or whatever, and it was just a learning tool. Absolutely. So, you know, there, this ability to describe and repeat people operations and machine operations, capturing a standard language for workflows, running it efficiently, operating your lab with it, seeing it run, seeing how it happens both virtually and physically. That's the game.
No, I was going to say, so you want to almost, you know, take a page out of Apple's playbook and have every university, you know, put this in place, right?
I mean, we're not starting in the academic segment, but it is natural to me, both as a learning tool and as a operational tool, that if you had a way to describe what needs to happen in a lab, it's a great learning system, especially if it can be decoupled from the physical assets and run virtually.
Right.
We can. And I do keep coming back to the spreadsheet analogy, which I totally borrowed from National Instruments. You learn on a spreadsheet in school. You're not learning on a spreadsheet. So if we are the tool that we envision we should be used everywhere.
Right.
And we think the desire to repeat a lab operation and describe it digitally and then run it automatically is a universal desire for scientists. So it has really, really broad application. And then to your other question, you know, aspirationally, we want to be a hugely valuable key pillar in the life sciences space. I mean, obviously, if we realize that mission, we would be. This would be how, you know, scientists would share research that can be repeated, how we would efficiently operate diagnostics, execution in both the R&D side and on the production side. So we envision that we would be a highly successful software-based lab orchestration and operations company. I think there is a reality of the interaction of such software with instrumentation. And so you need good and strong partnerships with companies that are open to creating a modern digital ecosystem. This is really important for the community, like super important. And so you need as few walled garden strategies as possible by the instrumentation vendors.
Yep.
And so if you end up with silos of disconnected equipment and informatic systems that can't share, you know, sequencing results, you know, you're really, it's good for the single business, no doubt. It's bad for the lab and the world and the ecosystem to support it. The question for me is, can this market get to the same spot that other markets I've been in got to, which was the customers demanded in automotive that there were no walled gardens. Like the customers demanded it.
That's going to be hard, right?
It'd be really hard. And so your question is one I grapple with a lot, which is you have to absolutely have beautiful partners that are open to the digital ecosystem, like we do. And there are a lot of forward-looking companies, and you can look at who they are based off their participation in certain standards and standard bodies. And they're sort of this coalition of the willing company base of the supply chain, and we're partnering with them.
Yep.
And it really has to be, there's a technologically advantageous solution who's open and willing to play in the modern digital ecosystem concepts founded really by the internet, more or less, and then break down the walled gardens over time. And it really requires unified customers, a good technological solution, and enough critical mass in the instrument and automation supply hardware to pull it off. So that to me says crystal ball. I have a very, very clear vision for the company on technology. There's a lot of business alignment on the hardware side, but you know what's been great is I have great partners so far with great companies like Thermo, like Tecan and others who are open and view the world the same way. There's a digital ecosystem, they're a participant in it. Very few labs are solely supplied by one vendor. Like you walk into a lab, it's like, you know, I'm a pure Thermo house or whatever. It's like really rare. So I'm optimistic that there's a strong coalition already existing, and the further we go and the higher value we get, the more customers will demand it.
Yeah, well, let's hope it moves that way, because the faster we move things along, the faster we benefit all of us.
Absolutely.
So great having you on the show. I look forward to seeing, you know, how the company evolves. I'm definitely going to be, you know, watching, because, you know, this whole area is near and dear to my heart.
Absolutely. I appreciate the time today. The questions were great. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. That's it for this week's episode. You can find a full transcript of this episode, as well as the full archive of episodes of The Harry Glorikian Show and Moneyball Medicine at our website. Go to glorikian.com and click on the tab Podcasts. I'd also like to thank our listeners for boosting The Harry Glorikian Show into the top 3% of global podcasts. If you want to be sure to get every new episode of the show automatically, be sure to open Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast player and hit follow or subscribe. Don't forget to leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. And we always love to hear from listeners on Twitter, where you can find me at H. Glorikian. Thanks for listening, stay healthy, and be sure to tune in 2 weeks from now for our next interview.